All right, y'all. Welcome to the show. I always sound reluctant at the beginning of the show. All right. Because I want to listen to this song. Even though I hear it every day, I like it. I see right there was the part with the drums. Yeah. I like that. Mike D. All right. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I don't know who Ricky is, but that's his theme song. All right. Yeah, I'm Scott Horton. Oh, you know what? Nah, I'll leave it. It's fine. All right. Today on the show, Gareth Porter's going to be here. I'm interested in what Gareth thinks about all the developments in America's relationship with Iran and the possibility of a nuclear deal. Something tells me that he ain't optimistic. I haven't written any. I don't think he's written anything about it yet. But, you know, as we get more distance between that phone call between Obama and Rouhani. As long as we're getting more distance, or as we get more distance in time from that phone call. Oh, nice talking, Jesus. The less it seems to mean to me. At first I thought, wow, Obama called him. That really is a first. Man, that's a big deal. Man, maybe they really do mean to negotiate a deal here. Everybody knows the form of the deal. I'll let Gareth explain it. But the obvious deal for everybody to get what they want, except Benjamin Netanyahu, is pretty obvious to all. And I thought, wow, maybe unlike 2009, when Obama offered a deal to Iran, maybe this time he really means it. Maybe this time he really wants to see it through. Wouldn't that be nice? Hey, after all, he went ahead and made the phone call. But then again, you know, he went ahead and did a few new things in 2009, too. He called Iran the Islamic Republic of Iran. In other words, recognized the so-called legitimacy of the state from this state's point of view. And wished them Happy New Year and whatever the hell, all that. And it looked like, hey, maybe he really wants a deal, but no. And of course, the Israelis had their Jandala terrorists help screw that up back in 2009, too. Make sure that it was very difficult in Iranian politics to get the deal done. But anyway. So, I was pretty excited last week, thinking maybe Obama finally does want to make a deal. Again, like I said, the deal is obvious to all. It ought to be easy as pie. I've never been to diplomacy school at all, but if they made me the special ambassador to Iran, I could have a deal in an afternoon. Everybody knows what the deal is. But anyway, he is just the president. And as time goes on, my feeling about it has changed a bit, I guess. I'm trying to be optimistic. I think part of it was I'm just so relieved who's not the president that I sort of confused that relief with the feeling that I ought to have being able to trust this one to really see it through. Yeah, right. The only things that he does that he promised he would do are horrible things, like make America's fascist healthcare system even worse. Oh yeah, we're going from Mussolini straight to Hitler in healthcare here. Okay, perfect. Those kind of promises he'll keep. Double down the war in Afghanistan, spread it to Pakistan. Oh yeah, there's one where he'll follow through. But close Guantanamo Bay. Yeah, actually, back down on the Syria thing. Got to give him credit. His his lack of stick-to-itiveness worked to our benefit on that one. But anyway, I don't know. We'll see what Garrett says. That's just a long way of saying Garrett's going to be on the show. I'm going to ask him what he thinks, and then he's going to answer for a while. It's going to be great. Also, Jacob Hornberger is going to be here. He's from the Future Freedom Foundation, and I'm going to ask him all about the coup in Chile. And yeah, I know. If I wasn't so lazy, I would get some Chileans on to talk about that. But you know what? I am lazy, and I like Jacob Hornberger. And Jacob Hornberger is taking a real interest in this Chilean coup d'etat thing from back when. All these years. It's the 40th anniversary now. So he wrote a 40th anniversary piece. Of course, it's Chile is September 11th. It was September 11th was the day of the American coup. So anyway, Hornberger's going to be on the show. We'll talk about, the Republicans. And what they done did. These guys are mean. Anyway. So that should be fun. Yeah. And then, between now and then, I'm going to talk about the news. First, I guess I'll mention, I got a website. Man, I need coffee. Hang on one second. First, I guess I'll mention, I got a website. ScottHorton.org. And at ScottHorton.org, I got 3,000 interviews dating back to 2003. 3,000 interviews for you there at ScottHorton.org. Also, if you go to ScottHorton.org/chat, you can join up the chat room and hang out with the boys and girls during the show. They're just like you. They love the show, too. And they're all hanging out in the chat room. Well, no, a few of them are. They're at ScottHorton.org/chat. You don't need a X-Chat or a Chatzilla or a Pigeon or a whatever the hell kind of newfangled applications and programs and plugins and add-ons you kids use nowadays. You don't even need that. Just plain old browser window. Type in a fake name and a CAPTCHA and you're in. ScottHorton.org/chat. That's nice. Occasionally, it's very helpful to me. But it's always nice just to see people showing up and hanging out and talking with each other about El Caminos or whatever is important. I like to pretend when they're not chatting, but they're just sitting there, I like to pretend it's because everybody's paying rapt attention. Rather than they just left the thing open and haven't been back in a week. Anyway. ScottHorton.org/chat. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. And apparently, I don't know what it was. Did I say something nice about Jews? Or did I oppose a war in Syria that the Democrats told you was going to make you feel real good about yourself for a little while? Or what it was that made everybody angry? But I lost a whole bunch of Facebook friends. They had a glitch there for a while where, even though I have more than 5,000, for some reason they weren't all getting counted, so my number would be lower than 5,000. So I would have a ton of friend requests going way back. So I kept adding and adding and adding, and I ended up with like 5,100 friends before they got their glitch fixed. I can't do that anymore, add more than 5,000. It won't let you because now the glitch is fixed. But I lost that whole 100 or so. I don't know what it was. I don't know. Maybe I called everybody a stupid jerk and they took it to heart. I don't know what it was. You stupid jerks! I don't know. But anyway, so you know what that means? That means I only have 4,990 Facebook friends. Now, I know I should switch it over to the public profile thing where you get likes instead of friends and whatever. But I've already had this thing since 2007, and I've already got 5,000 friends. And I think I can only merge the public one into the private one rather than merge the private one into the public one. If I can take all of my friends and make them likes and keep them and take the address of the main one I got now, / Scott Horton Show, and make that the address for the public one, well then, yeah, I need to figure out how to do that. But when I looked into it a little bit, the best I could understand, I can't do it that way. I could make the public site that gets likes, I can merge that into a Frenzy one, but I can't merge a Frenzy one into a likesy one, if you know what I mean. And either way, I think I used up all my changes of addresses that I was going to ever be able to use too. Possibly. But whatever, dude. Anyway, all I'm saying is, if you want to be Facebook friends, we can be. Facebook.com/Scott Horton Show. And that's the Twitter address, too. Twitter.com/Scott Horton Show. And if you like watching me give speeches to people about things, it's like the radio show, only on video. ScottHorton.org. No, YouTube.com/Scott Horton Show is what I mean to say. Actually, that's not true. Actually, both things are true. If you go to ScottHorton.org/speeches, you can see them all there. Is it /speeches? Oh, crap. See, now I might have got that wrong. What is it then? It's /something. Yeah, it is /speeches. ScottHorton.org/speeches. And also YouTube.com/Scott Horton Show. If you like that kind of thing. How boring. Okay, so that's all the housekeeping stuff for the show. Now to the bad news, before we get to our great interviews. Boy, I better check my email. Looks like I got a bunch of them. Okay, that'll be fine. All right. Iranian Revolutionary Guards probe officer's horrific death. Huh. Remember a minute ago when I accused the Israelis of killing Iranians in October of 2009 in order to screw up the political atmosphere in Iran to make it more difficult for Ahmadinejad to make a deal with Obama back then? They say that Ahmadinejad wanted to do the deal more than Khamenei at that point. There was another point in time, maybe it was the next spring, where it was the Supreme Leader wanted to do it more than Ahmadinejad did anymore. I get that story screwed up and switched back around. I guess it don't really matter. But the point being that there was a internal dispute in Iran. It was not as settled as it is right now that, yes, we really want to make a deal. And in fact, I think the way I remember it was Ahmadinejad who was really pushing to make the deal. But then you know what happened? The Israelis hired some Al-Qaeda terrorists known as Jandala, Al-Qaeda-ish terrorists, Al-Qaeda-like terrorists, the kind of guys that we would kill in Afghanistan or Iraq or back in Libya or Syria or Lebanon, if you know what I mean. You know, bin Ladenites. Takfiri, Salafist, Wahhabite, Sunni suicide bomber, prisoner beheader types. Like the kinds that our guys fought in Iraq for 8 years there. Well, I mean, it was the Americans who invaded, so it's kind of what happens. But anyway, the Israelis hired some guys like that. They call themselves Jandala. And it's a different Jandala than the one that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed used to be the head of, I found out. I used to conflate those two. In case you ever heard me conflate those two, this is a correction. I've made the correction before in the past, but just to make sure. There are two different Jandalas. This is not the one that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed used to be the head of. But same difference, man. They're Baluchi bin Ladenites. Only on the Syrian, on the Iranian side of the border instead of the Pakistani side of the border. And anyway, the Israelis hired them. Apparently, if you read foreignpolicy.com, apparently the Israelis, posing as American CIA, hired these Jandala terrorists to murder Iranian Revolutionary Guards, including a general, back in October 2009. And that helped ruin the deal. I don't think Obama was ready to accept their acceptance of his deal anyway. He certainly refused to accept their acceptance of the same deal 6 months later. After he asked the Brazilians and the Turks to make the deal for him, and they did, and the Iranians accepted it, and then he went, no, I can't hear you, Mary had a little lamb, blah, 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 blah. No deal. When it was his deal. And then, of course, even then in October of 2009, Obama, just like we talked about the other day on the show, had the whole hoax of the outing of the COM facility 4 days after it was declared by the Iranians. Wow, what a surprise. So, it's not like Obama was an honest broker until the Israelis hired some bin Ladenites to kill some Iranian Revolutionary Guards generals in order to scotch the deal. But it sure didn't help! And now the headline today, man, maybe I should be kind of quiet about this, because I don't want to help screw up a deal if that's what's going on here. Iranian Revolutionary Guards probe officer's horrific death. Iran's Revolutionary Guard says they were investigating the death of an officer in a horrific incident, but denied media reports it was an assassination. Now see, that's the all-important thing. This guy, Mojtaba Ahmadi, they're saying, an official of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, was found shot dead near Karaj, a town northwest of the capital, Tehran. The Daily Telegraph reported that Ahmadi was a commander of the unit's cyber war headquarters and quoted a local police commander saying it was an assassination. It speculated, the Telegraph speculated, that the death could have been an assassination similar to those of five Iranian nuclear scientists since 2007. What they don't finish in that sentence there is murdered by the Mujahideen-e-Khalq communist terrorist cult working for the Israelis. And I know that when I say somebody is a communist terrorist cult, it sounds like I'm just smearing them and engaging in hyperbole or something. But no, really, these guys are crazies. Talk about just, you know, if you want to highlight ever the bankruptcy of American foreign policy, let's look at our backing of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, M-E-K, or MKO, Mujahideen-e-Khalq Organization, they call themselves, the MEK, Communist Terrorist Cult. They used to work for Karl Marx and Workers' Revolution. Then they worked for the Ayatollah Khomeini, the most right-wing guy post-Hitler anyway in the 20th century. And then, after that, they went to, they are traitors, guilty of the worst treason. They went to work for Saddam Hussein. In him and Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan's war against Iran. And then, George W. Bush inherited them. America inherited them from Saddam in 2003. And, as my wife reported for Raw Story back in, 2005... Larissa Alexandrovna. I never can say her name right, actually. I'm a Texan. Cheney and Rumsfeld were using them inside Iran. According to Scott Ritter and some others, they were blowing up bombs in Iran as early as 2005, and they were definitely behind a lot of the assassinations. Is that what this is? And how important is it, you think, that the government is playing it down over there? Trying to not let the deal get scotched. Man, that Netanyahu... It ain't proof, but I'm suspicious. Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey everybody, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the Journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Now, you know, they publish great articles at fff.org every day, but their best stuff goes in The Future of Freedom. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online, and I got a new one coming out in September in there, U.S. Responsible for Somalia's Misery. Support FFF. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe and tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Guess we're kind of celebrating. You could say that. We're celebrating 3,000 interviews since 2003 this week. Ann Jones was number 3,000. Well, at least post number 3,000 at scotthorton.org. That's not an exact count, but it's pretty damn close. I got a blog entry there at scotthorton.org at stress there, explaining that I lost a few and I deleted a couple, and Angela Keaton and Zoe Greif recorded a few, so those don't count as mine, but anyway, those numbers more or less pretty much balance out, and it's right around 3,000 interviews there at scotthorton.org. And by the way, as part of our wonderful celebration, it's another little mini fun drive type of a thing here. I work real cheap, but I do got to be able to. I need to be able to continue to call Egypt from time to time. Also, I will need electricity to make my computers and microphones work. An internet so that I can read things. And it's true that I get a lot of my books for free, but not all of them. Then again, I don't read hardly nearly as many of them as I need to. I'm working on that. But utilities are expensive for keeping this show going. Just the cost of showing is a thing. And then there's the cost of living, which is a little bit more. And then I'm making improvements. We got, of course, the new and improved scotthorton.org, which is great, but I need to hire a real genius to customize the front page for me real well, and that's going to cost a little bit of money to do. And then there are some online services that I need to work with and get with for better ways to distribute the show and some different things. And so a little bit of expansion, a little bit of improvement, I hope. Coming in the distribution of the show. And, you know, yeah, whatever, I don't know. Celebrate the fact that Russia saved America, saved the Americans from our government getting us into a war with Syria by donating to me. I had nothing to do with it. In fact, I wasn't even on the air covering what happened that week because I couldn't be. But anyway, I'm taking credit for wherever there's not a war. It's all because I tried to stop it and successfully stopped it. So donate to me. ScottHorton.org/donate. And there's all different ways to do it. If you're really into the Bitcoins, well, donate some Bitcoins to me. The more Bitcoins you have, the less it matters to you how many of them come my way. I might as well give him half of mine. I got so many, you might say to yourself. Whatever. Anyway. And if you donate $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show, I will send you a QR code 1 ounce silver piece. CommodityDiscs.com if you want to look at that. And Facebook.com/CommodityDiscs. The guy that does it behind the whole project is my friend Arlo Pignotti. He's a really good guy, and he sells these things for spot price plus very few, $4 or $5, I think, just for his cost. He's not making money off it, I don't think, very little anyway, if he is. Because the real point is he's an activist, he's just trying to get these out there. And I got to tell you, this is kind of a thing of mine. If you go back to 2004, you can hear me arguing with Bernard von Nothaus, which I always liked the idea of the Liberty Dollar an alternative silver-based currencies, even with paper notes, redeemable in silver, fine. Yeah, great. Except, I never liked the way he would write the face value on a piece of silver where that face value is implying in U.S. paper dollars. And yet the price of silver in U.S. paper dollars fluctuates all the time. So how can you just engrave $20 on it as though you're the government saying that that's the definition of $20 is an ounce of silver kind of thing. You know what I mean? So I never did like that. I always thought, you know, silver, if the spot price of silver is 10 bucks and your coin says 20 on it and you try to spend that at the store, then you're just ripping some guy off. You're basically defrauding him and making him believe that that's $20 worth of silver or that he can turn around and spend it on 20 bucks worth or whatever, which it's worth more than 20 now, but we're talking about way back in 2004 when it was 8 bucks an ounce. No, there's no inflation, though. But anyway, so that was always a thing of mine. Arlo Pignatti, why, he heard. He was paying attention, and he agreed with me. And he said, you know what we need to do now that it's the future and the technology is available? We'll put a QR code on the back of the disc. You know, like a, it's like a barcode, only it's the newfangled kind. You see them from time to time, right? Little weird patterns of black and white checkers, kind of square barcode looking thingamajig. It's for you to scan with your phone. You get a QR code reader app for your super intelligent smartphone. And you just scan that thing and it'll tell you whatever the hell. Well, you scan the QR code on the back of the commodity disc and it tells you the instant spot price. So you know exactly what it's worth on the market right now. Now soon, coming very soon, in fact, I think you'll be able to get them all priced. You'll know in gold. How much is this worth in gold? How much is it worth in euros? How much is it worth in yen? How much is it worth in whatever you want? And then, here's where we kick in the part where I have a dream. I have a dream that one day, everyone will spend silver as their common currency, like back in the old days, even with paper receipts for it. That's fine as long as it's redeemable, no fraud, whatever. And that we will all use the QR code to check out the instant spot price, compare it to whatever other metals or whatever other currencies we want, and the U.S. government dollar will cease to exist. Why should you have to trust in a picture of Andrew Jackson or U.S. Grant or Benjamin Franklin, the inflationist? At least he does fit on the $100 bill, doesn't he? Why should you have to trust in a picture of Alexander Hamilton when you can trust in silver? The QR code commodity disc. It's the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's the greatest thing that anybody ever invented. I think this ought to take off. I think this is the answer. And also, if you donate $100 to this show, you get one. You're about to hear a spot for it, too, in just a second. But that's a thing, by the way. All right. Back with more news in just a minute. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else is stickers suck. I never get tired of that, man. That's Dresden 45, by the way, if you want to go out and get that record. Swiss Bank Account is the name of the song. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is the Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, the great Gareth Porter and also the heroic Jacob Hornberger. See, I'm a Rothbardian anarchist libertarian type, so that means that everybody's either the great or the heroic. Not everybody, but most people. Tomorrow, the heroic David Enders will be on the show. David Enders was captured by Al-Qaeda in Syria and lived to tell about it. It's a kinder, gentler group of suicide bomber terrorists now. It's the new generation. They've learned from the errors of the past. If you let your reporter prisoners go without cutting their heads off, well, they might live to tell that you let them go without cutting their heads off. And that could serve as good PR for Obama and McCain if they want to send you and your jihadist friends some guns. See? Those Arabs are slick at public relations. Well, and you kind of got to admit, Zarqawi kind of proved to them what not to do. Here's how not to handle your business. But anyway, for real, man. Enders was captured. I forget now if it was, I guess it was by the Al-Nusra Front rather than the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham. Is that what they call it? That's the Arab term for the Levant, I guess. ISIS. Which is funny because that's the same acronym as David Albright, the liar, who's always trying to get us into war with Iran. David Albright, the terrorist. David Albright, you're such a terrorist. Anyway, so David Enders, he's going to be on the show, and I don't think he's been back to Syria in a little while. He spent at least the whole first half of the year in Syria. I'm not asking anything more of him than that. For crying out loud, man, go on vacation. He covered the Iraq War and the Libya War, too. I like David Enders. He's a good guy. I've been interviewing him for a long time. Anyway, so he's going to come on to talk with us about, you know, from an analyst point of view, I guess, rather than an original journalism point of view. Although his colleagues at McClatchy are, I think, the best on this. Mitchell Prothero has been writing a lot of good stuff, and Hannah Alam, too. Anyway, so he's going to come on to talk about, well, who are the moderates and who are the seculars and who are the different kinds of jihadists and what are the differences? And I guess some of the jihadist types are more interested in the bin Ladenite, Zawahiriite vision of taking the fight to the far enemy and, or at least, you know, seeing themselves as a united kind of Arab worldwide Sunni revolution. Insurgency as opposed to just a Syrian based one. So you could have, but you can still have, you know, people who are suicide bomber, jihadist, Zawahiriites in every other way, but are, you know, have enough of a tinge of Syrian nationalism, or at least maybe they're just picking their battles and fighting first things first here. We're fighting against Assad, and then we'll move on from there, or whatever their strategy is. But that seems to be, you know, more or less along the lines of the different splits there. Remember, it was David Enders that taught us that the cannibal, the madman, and you can read the BBC interview with the madman. It's just, boy, and the close-up picture of him, too, going, yeah, I'm a pretty crazy dude. Yeah, yeah, you are. Anyway, the cannibal, the guy who was eating the soldier's heart. Sorry if you have little kids nearby. Move your little kids away from the radio or put your iPod back on or something, because this is the part where Scott talks about how they killed this Syrian soldier and then cracked his chest open. And the guy, the Mujahideen warrior, you know, America's Mujahideen warrior, ripped the guy's heart out and ate it. Although some people dispute that and say, no, it was his lungs. No, it was his liver. Okay, yeah. I'm not an anatomy specialist or anything. But anyway, the guy's a cannibal. And it was David Enders that explained to us that actually that guy's a moderate. He's from the Farouk Brigades. And apparently they're not the Zawahiriites. They're not determined to create a Sunni Islamist state. They're not Salafists or Takfiriites or Wahhabiists or whatever. They want elections. The Farouk Brigades want elections. They're moderates. And there's Cannibal, yeah, one of them. Of course, then there's the Northern Storm Brigades. Those guys are moderates, too, except that they're on camera telling Time Magazine, yeah, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War, what? Which, maybe I'm interpreting, someone called me out on Twitter for this, maybe I'm going a little bit too leap to conclusions on this, but that sounds to me like he's a Zarqawiite. You know, the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq was, by super-duper majorities, a local Sunni Arab nationalist revolt in Iraq. And there were foreign fighters that traveled to Iraq to fight and to fight against the Americans. From Syria, from Libya, from Saudi Arabia, and other places in the region. Jordanians too, I'm sure, and whatever. And they came and they were, I think, never more than a very small percentage, 2 or 3% points. I guess the highest I ever heard was some general claim they were like 7% of the Sunni-based insurgency at the time. I think that is probably, you know, pushing it. And anyway, my best understanding, I can't think of a single piece of information anywhere in my neurons that I ever picked up during that whole Iraq war that said that you had any kind of legions of foreign Sunni resistance fighters who weren't part of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who weren't sworn, or, you know, after Zarqawi finally started calling himself Al-Qaeda in Iraq and swore allegiance to bin Laden, which wasn't until the very end of 2004. Almost 2 years after the insurgency started. But anyway, same group, the Zarqawiites, and then they called themselves Al-Qaeda in Iraq or the Islamic State of Iraq. Same guys we're messing with now. Isn't that the case? Is anybody in the chat room? Y'all ever heard of anybody, any foreigner Sunnis who traveled to Iraq to fight that war who weren't Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who weren't the Zarqawiites? Did they have any separate brigade of, you know, like the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, for example? Weren't they folded into Al-Qaeda in Iraq? Weren't they operating as Zarqawiites? Were they a separate brigade during that war? I guess I could get Bob Dreyfus or an expert like that on. I can't get Bob Dreyfus on. Maybe Jonathan Landay. Maybe David Enders could talk to me about that. You know, I should try to remember to ask him about that. Northern Storm. Here's my note to myself here. I gotta say it out loud so that you don't just hear dead air while I'm writing. Sorry, it's gonna sound like really lousy radio. Northern Storm Foreigners Iraq All Al-Qaeda. Because that's what I think. I think that when the guy from the Northern Storm Brigade looks right in the Time Magazine camera phone and says, oh yeah, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War, what? That what he's saying is, he's a member of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. These are the guys that John McCain went and met with and got his photo opportunity. These are the guys that John McCain wanted to spend the night at their house because Elizabeth Obagi, the pretend expert, said it was all kosher. He had security detail. You can read this in the Daily Caller, and which is, you know, more or less friendly. Maybe not really friendly to McCain. He's not their favorite Republican, maybe. But they weren't picking on him that bad, I don't think. All their sources were from his people. It's not like it was in... It may have been an expose, but Elizabeth Obagi didn't have a problem talking to them and giving them whatever quote they wanted. Yeah, John McCain, as Dan McAdams put it, wanted to have a pajama party with Al-Qaeda terrorists, with veterans of the Iraq War, where they fought against the U.S. Now, of course, I am the first to say, always was, that the Americans had no business in Iraq whatsoever. Certainly, the Sunni Iraqis, or whatever Iraqis, chose to violently resist the invasion of their country. They had the right to do that. I ain't saying that I celebrate the death of any American who was foolish enough to go get a job being a professional killer for George W. Bush. But, you know, these things do happen. I'm not saying all of their methods were good. They killed civilians. There's a horrible civil war, horrible sectarian cleansing. And, you know, I always pick on, especially because it was the Americans and the Iranians working together with the Shiite Arabs to so-called cleanse Baghdad of Sunni Arabs. But there were a lot of Shiites who were cleansed, as they call it, from the Sunni areas as well. There was a lot of brutality in that war. Certainly not justifying anybody's violence in it. Well, not celebrating it anyway. I would argue that if in a million years, when Iraq invades America, Americans will have the right to resist them. Simple as that. Everybody's got the right to resist a foreign intervention. But now, Syrians and Libyans and Saudis all traveling to Iraq to fight? I don't know what right they got. And certainly, if they're bragging to Time magazine that they fought against, presumably killed Americans in the Iraq war, you would think that that might could take them off the moderate list. That might put them on the list of fighters in Iraq that John McCain is not to spend the night with or pose for photo opportunities with. But these are the moderates. Here's the Washington Post, okay? CIA ramping up covert training program for moderate Syrian rebels. Well, it ain't very covert, is it, if it's on the front page of the Post? And here's a picture of a bunch of guys with beards and AKs. You know, this is like the iconic picture of Ronald Reagan meeting with the Afghan Mujahideen in the Oval Office. This is one of those things where 10 years from now, we're going to be like, yep, remember in the Post where these guys were our guys? Remember all the AKs we gave them? And anyway, CIA doubling down on training Sunni fighters. Oh, and then also, same newspaper, foreign extremists dominate Syria fight. Now, the best that our government can promise us is that the more that they back, they're vetted by Obagi. They're vetted rebels. The more that they back them, the more that they will limit the power and influence of the jihadists. And you will hear right-wing war party critics of Obama, people like McCain, accusing Obama of he should have done this a long time ago, and the longer he takes to back the moderates, like the Farouk cannibals and the Northern Storm Iraq War veterans, the better of an upper hand the so-called bad guys among the good guys gain. But the problem is with that is that the journalism all along has said that whatever weapons that they send, the ones who do the fighting are the ones who get the weapons. And the ones who do the fighting are not the moderates. Yeah, there are Northern Storm Brigades and Farouk Brigades, but they're not the leaders of this fight. It's not even their war. It's Al-Qaeda's war. You know, man, I don't have the clip of Hillary, do I? Wait a minute, I can queue it up. I need to get my sound bites queued up in my program here. I keep forgetting. Remember when my computer blew up a few weeks ago? Well, it's been more than a few weeks now. I still haven't gotten my act together to I don't have my sound bites. Anyway, it was a CBS News interview from March of 2011 where Hillary Clinton says, no, it was 2012, I'm sorry. She says, look, Zawahiri has endorsed the rebellion in Iraq. Are we fighting for Al-Qaeda? She says, Hamas has endorsed the revolution there. Are we fighting on the side of Hamas? We got to tread carefully here. And of course, she was one of the ones pushing the most for backing these guys. And yet even she admitted, I'm sorry to be redundant for people who have heard this before, but for people who haven't, it's quite informative, I think. See if I can get my key words good enough here. Yeah, see, it came right up. Let's see what we can get out of Hillary here, if I can cue it up to the right spot. I think it was toward the end, wasn't it? Oh, I got all my script blockers and my flash nullifiers and everything running here. Let's try again. Oh, don't play a commercial first. They might play a commercial first. No, oh, here we go.
National relief workers made it to the besieged...
being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad. If you're a military plant, you're not going to bring tanks over the borders of... base of operations in Benghazi, where you had people who were representing the entire opposition to Libya. You could get your arms around what it is you were being asked to do and with whom. We don't have any clarity on that.
But what's Madam Sir?
Which is such a lie. Holy crap. Remind me in a second to get back to that. Wow,
but
Hillary.
It is also important to stop and ask what that is and who's going to do it and how capable anybody is of doing it.
The U.S. has repeatedly said that it's reluctant to arm the dissidents. Why?
Well, first of all, we really don't know who it is that would be armed. This is not Libya, where you had a base of operations in Benghazi, where you had people who were representing the entire opposition to Libya. You could get your arms around what it is you were being asked to do and with whom. We don't have any clarity on that.
But Madam Secretary, what's the fear?
Well,
on the ground, what is the fear?
Well,
of arming the rebels.
What are we going to arm them with, and against what? You're not going to bring tanks over the borders of Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. That's not going to happen. So maybe at the best, you can smuggle in, automatic weapons. Where do you go? And to whom are you delivering them? We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that. We see immense human suffering that is heartbreaking and a stain on the honor of those security forces who are doing it.
Last Friday, the U.S. and Arab states announced...
So there you go. Now, she doesn't really discuss all the atrocities of the so-called rebels. And, of course, a little bit of irony in there. Well, it's a huge irony, but I don't want to get too far off topic, where she says, oh, yeah, in Libya, that was one thing, where all the rebels were good guys. We could just vet them, no problem. Really? Yeah, then 6 months later, the Benghazi attack happened and the ambassador was killed. Oops. Yeah, it turns out that was a bunch of Mujahideen veterans of the Iraq War, too. But anyway, and now she's the lady who spent all of last year pushing for Obama to arm the rebels more. And in fact, on her way out, remember at the end of last year... she, I think, primarily was behind the leak to the New York Times that said that she and Petraeus, who was the head of the CIA at the time, and Panetta, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, that they all three were pushing Obama hard to intervene in Syria more, to back the rebels more. And it was he who resisted them. But this was her leak. This was her saying, yeah, I'm a tough guy than Obama. And here I am on my way out, my last little claim to fame here. I tried to tell him. I tried to get him to intervene in Syria more, but he wouldn't. Well, and she sure as hell can't plead ignorance after the little speech she just gave CBS. Boy, can she. And I guess they don't really want a regime change. They've got to be smart enough to just barely entertain the thought experiment for a minute. What happens after the regime falls? What happens when there is no more Syrian army and there's no one except local militias between the Alawites, the Shiites, the Druze, different Kurdish factions, whatever, and the jihadist-led Sunni majority? Because again, the moderates ain't fighting. The moderates can be, you know, can sit around and have a little pretend government in exile, you know, and teleconference from Virginia all day if they want. That doesn't make them the bosses of anything. And there have been, you know, local town councils that have grown up and whatever, but the guys with the guns are the ones with the power. And so, you know, it's not like in Syria they have a long tradition of the local police force respecting what the town council says or anything like that. And, you know, I've never been to Syria. I'm not the world's expert on Syria, but every world's expert on Syria that I ever talk to say things like, man, this thing could go on for 15 or 20 years. This is so bad. Remember I was mentioning the other day, William S. Lind, who is from the Free Congress Foundation and is one of these OG conservatives, a Goldwaterite from a long time ago, and a mean old paleocon, if you want to call him that, anti-war guy since the end of the Cold War. Right-wing, paleoconservative, limited republic, and really conservative on the, you know, cultural front kind of a guy, and a military strategist, although I don't think a veteran, but a military strategist type. And he wrote an article for the American Conservative recently saying that one happy, and this is, again, from his point of view, very kind of right-wing, us-versus-them sort of guy, says, listen, and of course he blames our side for getting us into the fight. It's not like he's just some bigot, you know, like, you know, palling around with Frank Gaffney or something. He's a paleocon, not a neocon. But he's saying, one happy result of George Bush's worst stupid thing that anybody ever did in invading Iraq is that by turning over the capital city of Iraq to the Shiite Arabs, for the first time that they have controlled the capital of any Arab land of any description in 1,000 years, he has sparked a regional civil war. He's empowered the Iranians and the Shiites so much. He said the entire, every Sunni kingdom, emir, sultan, whatever, is in a total panic. And again, this is not about them fighting over who's a heretic and who's not. It's about just identity, who's different from who, who's us, who's them, and who's fighting on whose side for power. That's what it is. This is earth, not heaven or hell. And so to hear William S. Lind tell it, all right, now we can withdraw from the region and just let them fight it out. Because he does consider them our adversaries, if not our sworn enemies. At least some of them are our sworn enemies, would suicide bomb us if they could get here and do it. And he's saying, the suicide bombers, let them fight the Iranians. And Hezbollah, let them fight Al-Qaeda suicide bombers. Let them all suicide bomb each other and leave us the hell alone. It'll be like Bill Hicks said, the car bomb derby. We just got it started. Now you guys finish it off and we'll be over here in North America safe and sound like we always were in the first place if we had just stayed out of the hornet's nest. Now, you know, it sure is a lot different from what I imagine things could be like, only I guess mostly my imagination requires a time machine and requires Harry Brown winning the election of the year 2000. Because I think William Lind is right that it's just on. I wouldn't call it a happy consequence. It's the furthest thing from a happy consequence, but it is a consequence of the Republicans' war in Iraq, the regime change in Iraq. As I told you, for years and years and years and years now, the consequences of this are going to be playing out for decades and decades and decades and decades. This is the furthest thing from over. I mean, just look at Kurdistan as just one example. Type in Google Images. Go look at the shape of Kurdistan. Now, there's never been a Kurdistan. Except, I don't know, maybe in ancient times there was some autonomy here or there or something. I don't know. But they're dominated by the Ottoman Turks for how many centuries? And if you look at a map of the region of Kurdistan, you'll notice it's completely bisected by the states of Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Iran, and then even Armenia and Azerbaijan. And so there can be an independent Kurdistan after the end of a gigantic war that they somehow win someday. Or what? The leaders of all those states are going to say, you know what? Right is right. It's time to let the Kurds go. And for that matter, wouldn't there be a gigantic inter-Kurd civil war over who gets to be the leaders of the Kurds now? And whatever. The whole region is a catastrophe. Now, it's not like everything was going to work out just fine with Saddam Hussein around, but at least things were stable. You know? Think there was a possibility that you could have had a peace conference and could work these things out in the most reasonable ways you could try to do, you know? No, none of that. And there was, I'm sure they felt it over there the same way we felt it here about the turn of the new millennium. The brand new era dawning and whatever. And how's America spent it so far all this time? Driving the average Arab into the arms of Ayman al-Zawahiri. Instead of pointing and laughing at him as the kook on the corner that is a relic of a bygone era. Blew it. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against a depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hang on just a sec, y'all. I screwed up and called Bumper instead of Gareth first. I'll be right back. Hey, Gareth, it's Scott. Y'all set? All right. All right, kids, welcome back to the thing here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. 3,000 interviews at scotthorton.org. 1,000 of them with our next guest. No, probably almost 200 of them now. More than 150-something. My favorite reporter out of all of them. And foreign policy analyst, too. Independent historian and journalist Gareth Porter from Interpress Service, ipsnews.net, and truthout.org at truthout.org. Welcome back to the show. How the hell are you, Gareth?
I'm fine. Thanks again, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. Tell me everything that you think about last week's developments in negotiations with Iran about their nuclear program. Go.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, we don't know yet what the Obama administration is going to do because I'm sure they don't know yet themselves. This is one of those situations where we have to assume that the Obama administration is going to operate true to form, which means that decisions will be made at the last minute only when they're forced by the situation, and that we cannot tell from vague public pronouncements ahead of time what their intentions are. And I would also just say that we have to keep in mind the whole history of the Obama administration policy toward Iran, which is not at all encouraging, to say the least, in terms of the very sharp contrast between the kind of atmospherics that the Obama administration, particularly the White House itself, has created about its intentions toward Iran versus the reality of what it was doing secretly in the White House at the time. And, you know, I can sort of expand on that, but what I have in mind particularly is that the White House was saying in early 2009, spring of 2009, that it had every intention of engaging seriously diplomatically with Iran, whereas secretly what was really going on was that the president was approving plans for a cyber war against Iran, against the Natanz enrichment facility, which was being planned for, if I remember correctly, May of 2009. And so at the very moment that the president was professing his goodwill and his readiness to engage really for the first time with Iran in decades, he was actually doing exactly the opposite. He was planning war against Iran. And unfortunately, the fact leaked out later on, and it should have been a major embarrassment for the White House. It wasn't. So I just I want to put that in at the beginning of the conversation to mark my my skepticism about just how much we can expect of the administration at this point. Yeah. I would like to think that there'll be a breakthrough, but I think that's the baseline that we're dealing with.
Well, you know, what's funny about that to me is, It sort of sounds like what you're saying is that the White House, I guess the political advisor types, they figured out a way where they can have and eat their cake, right? They can pretend that they are pushing for peace, but at the same time, they can always turn to the hawks and say, yeah, but look what we're doing with our cyber war, and look at all the brutality of our sanctions, depriving cancer patients of medicine and stuff. Aren't we tough right-wing warmongers like you guys? And please both sides. But it seems like really what they're doing is they don't get to have their cake or eat it. They're just blowing it with both sides. They look like horrible warmongers to me, and they look like commie, Marxist, Kenyan, Muslim traitors to anyone who's pro-Israel. So what have they accomplished?
Well, I mean,
as far as domestic politics is concerned, I mean,
you put your finger on precisely the contradiction that still bedevils the Obama administration. I mean, it is a fundamental contradiction between its commitment, not just to Israeli interests, but that of course is a major fundamental problem for the White House, but also something that I've mentioned in the past, which is that the national security state of the United States also has its own autonomous bureaucratic interests in having Iran as an enemy for all kinds of reasons, relations with the Saudis, the prospect of huge profits for the U.S. armaments industry, which is closely, of course, related to the Pentagon, with the Saudis and other sheikhdoms in the Gulf, and the overall ability to use Iran as a justification for military presence in the Middle East. I think that's not a part of the story that gets any attention. It's much more difficult to identify and to show how it affects policy. But the fact that it does affect policy, I have no doubt about that.
Yeah. All right. Now.
And you're right that it's not a question of win-win; it's a question of lose-lose. I mean, in the process of trying to have it both ways, they do in fact simply leave both sides, both people who want peace and people who want the Israelis' interests to be served unsatisfied.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. The counterfactual is so easy to imagine, though. I mean, any one of us can just put ourselves in his position. If I was president, I would make peace, and I would tell the war party in a big public speech to go to hell. I'm Obama the Great. I just made peace with Iran. If you don't like it, tough. Go jump in a lake and watch the entire American people rise up in applause. Are you kidding me? This is so stupid.
You know, The problem with that position, Scott, of course, is that it requires some ethics and some gumption, and those are qualities that are not found
what
generally.
Ethics? He could be the worst, most selfish imperial tyrant ever, and still
no,
he could be Richard Nixon
that's
and go shake hands with Mao.
That's not the way it works psychologically. Okay, you know, set Nixon aside for a moment. I mean, think about JFK, LBJ, Clinton, and the whole cast of characters that we've seen in the White House, who are people who are not ready to sort of stand up and tell the truth, but rather who would be inclined to come up with some very Machiavellian behind-the-scenes approach to a situation where they face conflicting interests, conflicting needs, if you will, between public opinion or the Israeli lobby on one side versus the interests of the United States on the other. And I think particularly of JFK, I've written about that in great detail in my book on Vietnam, and how he was not ready to tell the truth about what the United States needed to do in Vietnam to get out of the war, to get its troops out, and instead, you know, had this extremely complicated scheme that he tried to push through with Robert S. McNamara to get the Joint Chiefs to embrace a withdrawal scheme. But, you know, my point here is simply that the psychological characteristics of the people who rise to the top in American politics simply do not lend themselves to the kind of posture that you're describing there. I mean, the fundamental orientation is somebody who would bow to, you know, the powers that be, whether they're in the Pentagon or in the Israeli lobby. Now, you know, last year we saw a very unusual set of events in which Obama actually did some pushback on the question of, you know, the red lines that Netanyahu was demanding that the United States embrace. And he said, no, we're not going to do that. So, you know, in extremis on the question of war and peace, when it's clear that the Pentagon does not want to go to war, he's willing to stand up to the Israeli lobby and to the Israelis. But when it comes to negotiating with Iran, it's not so clear.
Yeah. All right, now, well, you live near D.C. anyway, if not in it. I don't know. I'm way out here in Texas. But it sort of seemed to me like even on TV, the idea was, yeah, Netanyahu, our president is our president, and he's pursuing this peace thing, and we're going to go ahead and give that a chance for a minute. It seemed like his speech fell pretty flat, or at least nobody was really impressed by it or whatever. I don't know. How do you think it played in D.C. as far as, you know, Israel's pushback against Obama's at least pseudo opening here?
It's not playing well at all. I mean, I think that even people who are in some sense, you know, pro-Israeli and you know, support a you know, tough line on Iran felt that, you know, Netanyahu's lost his touch. And in fact, this goes back to the previous year's speech at the UN General Assembly. I'm sure you'll remember, and your listeners will remember, the famous cartoon bomb that was his prop in that speech. I think that was really the turning point where Netanyahu somehow was no longer able to communicate a message that made any, you know, positive reverberations abroad. I mean, you know, one of his leading supporters in the journalistic world, the guy who basically tried to sell the idea that Netanyahu was going to, you know, make war against Iran, the former jail trustee in Israel, Goldberg, you know, he tweeted after the September 2012 speech by Netanyahu that Netanyahu had made a joke out of something that was serious. So, you know, and I saw John Judis in the New Republic making extremely critical remarks about the Netanyahu speech. I think he's left people feeling very deflated. People who are in the Israeli camp.
Yeah. Now I'm just making this up, and I don't even really believe it. But back a few weeks ago, I was sort of speculating. Remember, you and I had talked about it. I thought I had got this part right, but no, I plagiarized this from you, that we'll see how hard Obama really pushes in Congress and whether the leadership, the Democratic leadership in Congress, really pushes for these Syria war votes or whether they let it be a conscience vote, how hard he's really trying. And then I even got to speculating and conspiracy theorizing that maybe, just maybe, I don't know why I want to like this guy at all, but maybe, just maybe, Obama asked AIPAC to help him push us into war with Syria because he already knew he wasn't going to be able to do it and that Congress was going to vote it down and that they were just going to make jackasses out of themselves, and he just wanted to help weaken them a little bit more before he moved forward with this Iran thing.
Well, I don't know about the AIPAC part of that. I mean, that would be maybe a bridge too far in my estimation. But definitely, it's not a conspiracy theory to see that that Obama used Congress for his own purposes. I mean, in other words, used the idea of going to Congress with the Syria use of force resolution, in the full knowledge that Congress was going to say no and that would give him an out.
Yeah. Well, they say that he called AIPAC and asked specifically for help, or I don't know he did, but you know, the White House called him and asked for help on that. And I just wondered whether he was going, excellent. I mean, that's what I would do. I guess there's the one quote is all I'm going by, is the one quote where he's talking to the French guy on the open microphone accidentally. And he's saying, you think you hate Netanyahu? I got to deal with him every day. Right. And I was just thinking, you know, if I was the president, how frustrated I would be with Netanyahu compared to how frustrated with him I already am. You know what I mean?
Well, look,
and I would try to do stuff like that to him if I could.
I can certainly agree that Obama would be very much willing to say to the AIPAC, yeah, please help me get this through, knowing that it wasn't going to happen and that this was a way of keeping up his relations with AIPAC while at the same time knowing that it was going to turn out his way, or it was not going to harm his plan. And in the background of this, by the way, I mean, there's very good reason to believe the United States, the Obama administration, and the Russians were talking about chemical weapons for months and months ahead of time. This was not something that just came up at the last minute. It was not a slip of the tongue. It was not an offhand remark. There's no question that this was something that they had been discussing, and that therefore there is a linkage here between U.S.-Russian talks on chemical weapons and what transpired over the last several weeks.
All right,
Oh,
okay, so yesterday I talked with Trita Parsi, and he wrote this new thing for Foreign Affairs saying, hey, Israel, relax. In other words, Netanyahu, relax. If America makes a deal with Iran, you're following five obvious fears. There are easy answers to them and why you shouldn't be so afraid. And this will actually, it'll be a lack of a common enemy for you to share with America for a little while, that kind of thing. But just think of all the benefits that you could get out of it. Like, for example, it turns out this guy, Rouhani, and his men, they're the same ones that offered the golden offer, the one that you reported for the American Prospect I don't know when you reported it first, but the golden offer of 2003, where the Iranians said, we will negotiate everything, including every part of our nuclear program, including our relationship with Hamas and Hezbollah, even.
Right, and I mean, they specifically made making peace with Israel a part of that negotiating proposal. I mean, this was a proposal that could only come from the accommodationist side of the Iranian political system. That is to say, the Rafsanjani group, which Rouhani was the great strategist for two decades. And this is, I think I've mentioned this on your show before, Scott, this is a strategic a fact of the highest importance, which, you know, again, any rational U.S. administration would take advantage of, and the Israelis and the Europeans as well.
Ah, crap, I just said all that into a dead mic. We'll be right back with Gareth Porter in just a second. Don't! Man, I'm bad at this. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'd let that play, but I got Gareth on the line here. Gareth the Great, Gareth Porter, from Interpress Service, author of Perils of Dominance. And what's the new one called, Gareth?
It's called Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare.
Oh, man, I can't wait to get my eyeballs on that thing.
We're thinking now it should be out in early February.
Ha ha, everybody, I got dibs. All right. Now, listen, I'm sorry. The break interrupted us, and boy, I sure blew that outro, didn't I? The break interrupted us. You were beginning to answer my question there about Israel's strategic interest in having Iran as a friend or an enemy and why they ought to go ahead. And even though there are some advantages to having them as an enemy, that, you know, at least you're... answering what Trita was saying in Foreign Affairs, what Trita Parsi was saying in Foreign Affairs, that, no, really, you'd be better off to have a peaceful relationship with Iran, or at least for America to have one.
Well, you know, I mean, this, of course, as I said, first of all, the point that he was making about Rouhani being the man they should deal with is absolutely fundamental. As I was saying just at the end of that segment, you know, he is the strategist, has been the strategist for 20 years for the Rafsanjani faction in Iranian politics, which is the faction which was always primarily concerned with reaching an accommodation with the West, integrating the Iranian economy into the global economy, the global capitalist economy, so that they could get the investments, the foreign investments and foreign technology that Iran needed to become a major economic powerhouse in the region. And that has been the leitmotif of the faction for all that time. And Rouhani has been at the beating heart of its strategy. So it's crazy, it's stupid for the West to fail to take advantage of this by reaching an accommodation with Iran and strengthening, strengthening the hand of Rouhani as president. And by the way, the former French ambassador in Tehran in 2003-2005, Monsieur Nicolot, has just written a blog in Le Figaro in which he talks about this precise point, that saying that, you know, it's time for the West to wake up and realize that it's in their interest to strengthen Rouhani's position by not playing tough, now not sort of denying the Iranians an agreement with the West and the United States on a nuclear program, but being accommodating and getting this agreement so that he's in a stronger position to continue the kind of policy that he wants to carry out. I think that's a primary point that bears a great deal of emphasis. And so Trita's right, of course. I would go even further and say that this general line that, you know, Israel should make peace with Iran, have peaceful relationship, even cooperative relations with Iran, is basically the viewpoint that Mossad has taken for decades. This is the old periphery doctrine. I have not seen Trita's piece yet, but I'm quite sure that he probably refers to it in Foreign Affairs, because that has been the Israeli viewpoint, the one that has guided Mossad for decades, has been that basically the interests of Israel and the interests of Iran have always been fundamentally aligned, even after the Islamic Revolution, because, you know, the real common enemy here is Sunni regimes in the region, which actually pose a more serious problem for Israel because of their ties with the Palestinian movement and the fact that they're all Arabs. The Mossad view, the periphery doctrine, has been that sooner or later there will be a way for Israel and Iran to once again cooperate. So, I mean, this is not something that's ahistorical at all. It's very much part of Israel's own history. But the Likud party under Netanyahu has really sort of kicked over the traces of that of that line, and has, for its own political reasons, has taken this sort of threatening war with Iran line, which I've always said is simply a ruse. It's always been a ruse, but it's one that serves their political objectives.
All right, so can you give me any kind of number chances on these talks actually working out? I mean, as we've discussed before, the outlines of the deal are pretty obvious if both sides want to be reasonable about it.
I don't know. I don't have any numerical coefficient for this. I'm not saying it's impossible that events could play out, that there could be a deal, but the structural obstacles to me have not changed. On balance, I would have to say less than 50%. I mean, I hate to say that. I mean, it's just the prospect of having to continue with this completely unnecessary and in many ways phony crisis with Iran is very depressing. I can't see precisely how this White House, which has shown so little willingness in the past to use up the political capital necessary to make that deal, would do so. I think that's really the critical question, Scott, is whether this president is going to say, look, this is important enough to me to get the deal that I'm going to use up a huge amount of political capital with Congress and with the pro-Israeli people to make it happen. Not impossible, but, you know, again, you go back to the psychological dimensions of this president, and, you know, it doesn't seem to be very likely.
All it would take is a little bit of courage, so so much for that.
Indeed.
Yeah. All right, and now this is just a technical thing, but I got in a little bit of an argument about Ali Gharib last week about whether the UN Security Council can go to hell or not for demanding that Iran cease enriching uranium when that right is guaranteed in the NPT, and every single member of the UN Security Council is a member of the NPT and are sworn to respect that right. And then he was saying, no way, if the Security Council votes a thing, then it's the world law, and Iran is bound to respect that even if it is in violation of the NPT.
Well, I mean, that, of course, is the official position of the United States and its allies, and it's a position that's based on might makes right. In other words, well, damn it, we have the power to say this, and therefore we can make the Iranians toe the line. That's what that amounts to. And, so far that's been the case. We can enforce it through essentially economic warfare.
Yeah.
But... I think you're absolutely right that the NPT should be the one that determines this question of Iran's right to enrich. And I'm glad you've raised that issue of the right to enrich.
Yeah, I mean... Because
I think that is at the heart of this. I mean, that's the first issue that this administration has to decide. I think that's the lesser of the two problems, the right to enrich and the willingness to rescind, to back off the economic sanctions against Iran are the two issues that are at stake here. And I think the right to enrich is the one that's easier for this administration to make a concession on. But it needs to do that, I think, up front. I think it needs to do that very soon. And so far, there's no sign that they're ready to do it.
Yep. All right, we got to go. Thanks, Gareth.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, everybody, that's Gareth the Great, IPSnews.net and truthout.org for Gareth Porter. And we'll be right back with Bumper Hornberger in just a second. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing. It's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. 3,000 interviews this week. I mean, not this week, but you know what I mean. As of this week, 3,000 interviews for you there at scotthorton.org. And, of course, you can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /Scott Horton Show. All right, next up is Jacob Hornberger. He's the founder and the president of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
It's an honor to be back. Thank you, Scott.
Well, good deal. Appreciate you joining us here. And you wrote about Chile, and I think it's, yeah, among people who are interested in foreign policy stuff, it's a little bit of trivia that down in Chile, they had their own 9/11. The U.S. supported coup back in 1973, and or maybe U.S. mandated coup, I don't know, back in 1973. But this is a subject that you've taken a special interest in over the years, and I'm sad to say it's not one that I've studied in depth. It's one that I've known about since I was very young, I guess, but it's not something I ever really studied. So anyway, I was really happy to see that you wrote about it on the 40th anniversary here a couple weeks ago, and so I was hoping you could help kind of fill in people, especially the young, about what was America's business in Chile back in 1973.
Yeah, it's an absolutely fascinating story. I mean, it's sort of a microcosm of the whole Cold War, anti-communist, foreign interventionist nonsense that was going on by the national security state. And what the situation was is that, you know, the national security state had built up this whole thing about the communists are coming to take over America, and the dominoes are going to fall, and, you know, we've got to sacrifice, you know, 58,000 American men in Vietnam and all this stuff. So all of a sudden,
Go right ahead.
So the Chilean people democratically elect a man named Salvador Allende to be their president, and he is a socialist. He's a communist, self-avowed communist. He believes in the whole socialist economic paradigm, and so President Nixon says, "Oh, we can't let this stand. You know, the Chilean people, they've elected this guy, but we can't allow that. This is a threat to our national security." You know, even though, of course, the thought that the Chilean army was going to somehow another sweep into the United States and conquer the United States was, you know, so ridiculous. But this same old national security nonsense. So he says he sends the CIA in there to create to add to the economic chaos, since Allende has had a socialist economic system, you would expect there would be chaos. But Nixon sends the CIA with orders to make it worse. And so the CIA is initiating a huge strike, like of truckers that were delivering food. They were paying them on the side so that they didn't have to worry about, you know, where their income was coming from during the strike. So there's this massive chaos, all with the notion of getting a military coup to take over. And so that happens on 9/11/1973. The Pinochet military coup takes place. Pinochet's a military general. They take over the National Palace. Allende commits suicide, apparently. And it starts its brutal reign of terror, where they torturing and raping people, they killing people, and all because they're socialists, not because they were taking up arms or resisting this coup or anything. It was because they had committed the crime of being communists or socialists. And so they kill, I don't know, 3,000 or 4,000 people. They round up and torture about 60,000. And in the midst of this, Scott, there's two Americans who are like leftists, you know, they believe in, you know, Franklin Roosevelt's philosophy and stuff, and they're executed during the first few days of the coup. They're executed, and of course the CIA and the military, the U.S. military, saying, "Oh, well, we don't have anything to do with this. We're just bystanders." Well, as it turned out, they were playing an active role in this coup, and as it further turned out, many years later, it looks like the CIA and the military helped kill these two Americans. And that's why one of the reasons I'm so fascinated by it is that nobody's ever done anything about that. Now, they've recently indicted a military official, a U.S. military official in Chile, for participating in the murder of one of those two Americans, or maybe both Americans. But the Congress has never done anything about it. The Justice Department has never done anything about it. It's amazing.
So it's not even that the Americans helped cover it up or asked the Chileans to do it. It sounds like, the way you put it in the article, they were last seen hitching a ride with an army official back to the base or something.
Yeah, what it was, you got two separate murders. One was Charles Horman and the other was Frank Tarugi. And they were both, I don't know, about 30 years old. And they were both leftists. And Charles Horman's story is the subject of the movie Missing. And so if you're... listeners have never watched that movie, it's really worth checking out. Jack Lemmon's in it, Sissy Spacek, and it's the story of what happened here. That Charles Horman is over on the seacoast. He lives in Santiago, but he and a friend, who's a woman, a friend of the family, he was married. He's taking her sightseeing in, I think it was Viña del Mar. And lo and behold, that's where the coup starts. And so he happens to witness a lot of the stuff. He sees American battleships out in the waters. He sees American soldier types being able to get through the checkpoints without any problems. So he's mentally recording this or writing it down and so forth. He's a journalist. And so all of a sudden there's a U.S. military guy that takes him back to Santiago to get him through the checkpoints and stuff. But that military guy figures out that this guy's a leftist and that he has seen things that shouldn't be seen, because the U.S. government was saying, we play no role in this. So all of a sudden, Horman has all this information that says, that's just not true. And many years later, a document was released by the State Department. Mrs. Horman, his wife, files a lawsuit and gets nowhere. The courts throw her out for lack of evidence. And they won't let her take depositions of anybody. And many years later, a State Department releases a document, I don't know if it was inadvertent or what, that says, well, yeah, the CIA played a role in this execution. And then, like I said, the Chilean officials have recently, like in the past couple of years, indicted that military guy that gave him the ride. He was an American military guy. And that extradition request has not yet been processed here in the United States, but you know, there's no question that the U.S. government's going to resist it. At least that's my opinion. And then Frank Tarugi He was murdered separately, and we don't really know what the circumstances of his murder are, but his sister just a few days ago published an op-ed saying, you know, what role did U.S. intelligence play in my brother's murder? And what she says is that all the evidence indicates that U.S. intelligence was monitoring Frank Tarugi's mail that he was sending home to his family in the States, and that he was telling his family, don't let anybody know where I live because it's dangerous down here in Chile. And yet the Chilean officials found out where he lived, and that Frank Tarugi's family has evidence indicating that they were monitoring his mail, just much like the NSA is doing to people today, and that's how the Chilean officials found out where Frank Tarugi was. Wow. Now, again, we don't know the exact role that the U.S. has played in these two executions. They are still keeping many of the documents and many of the records secret, and Congress has never held a hearing in which they could subpoena officials to find out exactly how these two Americans died and what role the U.S. had in it.
After 40 years, no accountability whatsoever.
None. I mean, this is the CIA we're talking about. I mean, you know, you really think that the Congress is going to jack with the CIA? You know, start subpoenaing people saying, who were the agents that killed them? And,
no.
And more important, or equally important, I should say, did the President of the United States authorize the hits? See, that's what's so fascinating is nobody wants to know. We're not supposed to ask these questions of how high did this go? Did they participate in the execution of these two Americans just on their own, or did they clear it up with higher ups and say, do we need to, should we go ahead and get rid of these guys?
All right. Now, first of all, at the Pirate Bay, they've got missing. I'm downloading it now. So just so people know. I've never seen that, so thanks for the recommendation. But then, now here's the thing of it. I remember after 9/11, maybe even a few years after 9/11, hearing people say that, yeah, well, you know, they had a 9/11 down in Chile. That was the coup against Allende, which I had known about the coup, but I didn't know about the significance of the date and all that, right? Someone put the two and two together for me there. And I remember thinking, and you know me, I'm not much for American foreign policy or Nixon and Kissinger or anything like that. But I remember thinking, not even really in words, but just sort of having the very vague feeling like, yeah, right, your 9/11 was nothing compared to what happened to us, sort of a thing, right? But then the truth of it is, no, that's not right at all. That's only right because I'm from here, not there. What happened there, as you said, thousands were killed in the fascist dirty war. You know, it wasn't even a counterinsurgency or anything. Their victims weren't even fighting back violently, right? This is just a Stalin-style roundup of these people.
That's absolutely right. They were just stopping them on the streets and putting them in a car, carting them away to a dungeon, and they would tell them, your life has come to an end. No one will ever hear from you again. And they proceeded to torture them, to rape them, and then the ones they killed, they would drop them off in the ocean and drug them up a little bit and then just drop them in the ocean. And so some people disappeared. They call them this apedecidos, where you never heard from again. You don't even know. There's no accountability at all as to some of the people they killed, and there's still stories. I mean, anybody that wants to just get like up to date, just Google Pinochet, and there's still stories of where people are suffering, you know, from the effects of the torture that they underwent. And oh, by the way, it may very well have been the model for the Bush Obama's war on terrorism, because what Pinochet was doing was exercising the same kind of powers that Bush and Obama claim as part of the war on terrorism, the power to go round people up, use the military to indefinitely incarcerate them, torture them, and execute them. And now, you know, Obama and Bush say, well, we would use a kangaroo tribunal, and Pinochet's position is we don't need any tribunal. These are communists, and we got a war on communism, and we can just kill them. And U.S. officials loved this. I mean, to them, it was like fantastic, because here, you know, Vietnam was wrapping up. We had lost 58,000 American men fighting the communists, and they looked at Pinochet killing all these, quote, communists and not losing any troops at all to speak of. They thought he was just a fantastic hero. In fact, many conservatives still consider him a hero. The Wall Street Journal just recently said, we hope Egypt finds its own Pinochet.
Yeah. You know, I was going to ask you about that, but first, real quick, before we get to the conservatives, did Allende even have a deal with the Kremlin? I mean, you say that he was a communist, and you know, again, I'm no scholar on this subject, maybe a self-avowed one, but was he really making the country a communist country? He was just raising taxes through the roof in a socialist kind of way, or he was really seizing all the means of production, and then secondarily then, or I guess, you know, secondary question to that, was he really straight aligning himself with the Kremlin and against the United States in the Cold War? Or is this just a matter of a nation declaring independence from the U.S., and that's what's really not tolerable here in this hemisphere?
It was the last. That this is a country that had no alliances or agreements or treaties or whatever with the Soviet Union. Nothing of that was going on. It was part of this nationalist movement that across the world in Latin America, Asia, and so forth, where they're not aligned with anybody. But here's a guy that wins. He had run for president before. He was an avowed socialist. In a sense, he was no different from Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, he just had that liberal, in the corruptest sense of the term, socialist interventionist mindset. Now, but he was more than that. He was also a person of a communist philosophy. Now, of course, what does that mean? But in economic terms, yeah, he believed in everything the communists believe in. And there was a very strong communist party in Chile. But I saw a film recently on the events leading up to the Pinochet coup, and it was absolutely fascinating, Scott, because they have, and this is a recent documentary that was done, but I was watching the speeches that were being given. There was all this democratic vibrancy, and of course it focused on the communist type speeches of people that talking about we need to do this and we need to do that, and it was the type of things you were talking about. We need to nationalize this and we need to do this. The thing you would think a communist socialist would advocate. But from what I can tell, and I've never been able to find any source to the contrary, there was no roundups that were taking place like you found in East Germany and Poland and Czechoslovakia. There were no dungeons. Allende wasn't rounding people up that were dissenting against his rule. Now, I could be mistaken on that, but every time somebody's raised that with me, I said, give me a source, and nobody's ever given me a source. So there was all this democratic vibrancy taking place, but there was no alliance. Now, was he adopting socialist principles economically? Absolutely. And there was certainly chaos, but it's hard to distinguish how much of that chaos is due to his socialist policies versus what the CIA was doing, because the CIA was adding to it. But the paranoia was coming about from Washington, because they saw, whenever they saw somebody like this, you know, an independent country electing a socialist or a communist or whatever, that this was like a major threat to the United States, because they saw this as one giant communist, monolithic, Soviet-driven movement or Chinese-driven movement, when it wasn't anything like that. There was never a threat to, quote, national security. Nothing like that.
Yeah, it's to their advantage to believe that ridiculousness. I mean, come on, they could tell the difference between whether Chile is now a satellite of the USSR or not. You know, that's just a convenient excuse.
Exactly.
He's so pink, he looks red from here.
It was a justification to maintain the national security state that had come into existence after World War II. And remember, they had had successes. They had knocked out the elected prime minister, the parliamentary elected prime minister of Iran in 1953. They had knocked out Arbenz in Guatemala in 1954. And then in 1973, you've got this. You've got all the regime change operations against Cuba, Castro. In fact, there's a great new book on this. I'm only about a third of the way through, but it is absolutely fantastic. In fact, he'd be a good guest on your show, and that's Stephen Kinzer's book called The Brothers. And it's about Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles, who were behind these early coups, the Guatemala coup and the Iranian coup, and I presume he's going to get into all the Castro stuff.
Yeah, I want that book, definitely.
So this thing with Chile is just a continuation of this national security state.
The Rockefeller's lawyers, that's who they are, the Dulles brothers.
Yeah.
The Rockefeller's lawyers. And then after World War II, one of them becomes the head of the CIA and the other one becomes the Secretary of State. And they rule everything for 8 years straight, 9 years straight.
Yeah, they fundamentally altered the course of American history with what they were doing.
Then you got to love that Ike Eisenhower on the last day. He goes, by the way, everything I just did screwed you real bad. Good luck protecting yourselves from the military-industrial complex that I just created for you.
Yeah, that's a fascinating deal. I mean, it was like he saw the light there at the end and had a crisis of conscience where he felt like he had to issue this warning to us. And it is kind of cynical that he waits to the end, but at least he did it. I mean, at least we can point to that here's Ike Eisenhower saying this is a bad news thing that we brought into existence here. It is a threat to our democratic processes. It's a threat to our economic well-being. And look where we are today.
Now, here's something. Conservatives, some of them, as you said, like in the Wall Street Journal, openly praise Pinochet, and progressive types would love to pretend that Jacob Hornberger and the libertarians love Pinochet too, because after all, the Chicago School and the Milton Friedmanites associated themselves with Pinochet and helped give him economic advice and such like that. What do you say?
Yeah, that's kind of a fascinating aspect to this, because I get criticized sometimes. I get emails from people in Chile that were Pinochet supporters, and they said, "Don't you know how bad Allende was? And he was a socialist and a communist." And from the U.S. standpoint, there's no question that the U.S. had no business intervening. I mean, the U.S. didn't have to take sides. The Chilean people might want to take sides, a communist versus a fascist, but there is absolutely no issue as to whether the U.S. should have been butting into this thing. But when we argue against this thing, we're not saying that Allende was this fantastic president. I mean, we're libertarians. We oppose socialism. We oppose communism. But this wasn't a revolution. This was a military coup. And it was a fascist coup, which ended up killing 3,000 people or so and rounding up, arresting and torturing some 50 or 60,000 people, including, the major poet of the country. It was incredible, the people that they were killing. So conservatives look at this and say, they were killing communists, and oh, by the way, they also established a free market economic system, because he was using a lot of Milton Friedman's proteges from the University of Chicago to establish a quote free market system. It really wasn't free market at all, and conservatives look at this as like, well, Pinochet's our hero. Well, how can you ever portray somebody as a hero that is out torturing and murdering and raping innocent people? And I say that a person that holds a communist view is an innocent person, Scott. I mean, why aren't people free to have whatever view they want? They're not initiating force against the state. They're not rebelling. They're not revolting or anything like this. It's just their mindsets, and that's what they were being killed for, and that's what I've never been able to understand about conservatives, is how they can portray a murderer, a rapist, a goon like this as a hero.
Yeah. Well, conservatives call the George W. Bush era free market capitalism, too, because that's what free market capitalism is to a conservative. It's them collecting welfare checks from the national government.
Excellent point. Absolutely excellent point.
So they look at Chile and they're like, yeah, exactly. That's how we do it. And we call it freedom.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, they consider our current system to be free enterprise. And that's why they're over there, so thank God I'm an American, because at least I know I'm free. And let's praise the giant military industrial complex and the national security state for defending my freedom and stuff.
Right. Yeah, Barack Obama, he's not all bad. He's a bit like Pinochet. We like him. He's okay.
Right. I mean, and you do see that with conservatives supporting a lot of what Obama does, not necessarily on his Obamacare, but certainly on his assassinations and his invasions and occupations and torture and indefinite incarceration and Guantanamo. They love it.
Well, there's even an article at LouRockwell.com today reminding us that conservatives invented Obamacare in the first place. This is Heritage Foundation care. This is Newt Gingrich care, the alternative to Hillary care. Remember?
Yeah, the thing about conservatives, you know, is that they just want their own little status reform plan in. They may object with, you know, Obama's particular one. But, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if conservatives had come up with their own variation of Obamacare. I mean, this is what conservatives do. They believe in socialism. They portray themselves as free enterprise, and they argue over which reform of Medicare and Medicaid and interventionism should be adopted. While we libertarians, we truly believe in free markets. We'd get rid of Medicare and Medicaid and occupational licensure and regulation, but we believe in freedom, and we stand for freedom, unlike conservatives.
Yeah, and freedom always takes the rap for their errors. You know, they celebrate Alan Greenspan for a generation and call him the maestro when all he did was set us up for the world's worst fall.
Well, right, and they don't ever challenge the existence of the Fed itself. You know, they'll say, oh, well, we put a free market guy like Alan Greenspan, you know, Ayn Rand acolyte here, and that makes us free enterprise. Well, that's nonsense. Free enterprise is ditching the Federal Reserve and having a free market monetary system.
Well, even John Stewart on The Daily Show recognized that and was like, well, hey, Alan Greenspan, how come we don't have free market interest rates? And Alan Greenspan just goes, because I'm better at it than the market is. That's why, son.
Yeah, he's a free market central planner.
Yeah, there you go. And really, really bad at it, apparently. All right. Well, anyway, tell me real quick. I saw that you wrote this great review of Mike Swanson's book, The War State. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about it. I'm going to start interviewing him next week on it.
I can't say enough great things about this book. I mean, this is a fantastic book. I've been studying the origins of the national security state for many years now. I mean, I'm very interested in how this system came into existence that we're living under. And here's a guy that has written a fantastic book on the Cold War origins of this whole system we're living under, the national security state, military, the standing army, the military empire, the CIA, the NSA. And it's a very readable book. I got through it in 3 evenings. It's not an academic tome. It's oriented toward, you know, regular people, the educated layman. And I can't think of a better summary of how we got to where we are today and the disastrous consequences in this book. It is absolutely fantastic.
You know, as of right now, I'm only just barely into it. I've had a lot of other stuff on my plate here, but I got the feeling immediately, like, this could maybe be the one that makes this no longer the alternative view, but that makes this really the mainstream view in America. That, you know, where we went wrong was after World War II, we never abolished the army, you know? And just kind of get it straight.
And he goes into that in every war, and there's been plenty of wars, that we always demobilized. And the exception was after World War II, and he shows how this whole Cold War mentality got started, the Truman Doctrine, another big document that remained classified from the American people for some 30 years, NSC 68, mm-hmm. and the role that played in the growth of the national security state and the big armaments industry, how we ended up with the whole thing today, the consequences. I'm telling you, I mean, there's plenty of books out there that give this story, but they're very, you know, like 5-inch thick, and they got tons of details. This book is the best encapsulation of where we are and how we got here that I've come across.
Awesome. Well, cool. I'm sure he'll appreciate you saying that too. I already quoted you in your article for the commercial for the book. He's been a sponsor of the show, Mike Swanson. He runs WallStreetWindow.com, and so we're running ads for the book on the show too, and I'm going to start interviewing him in pieces about it. Of course, this is just, I think, the first in a series of books too, just through the Kennedy years. So we're just getting started with that. That's The War State by Michael Swanson. Anyway, thank you very much for your time, Jacob. It's always great to talk to you. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
That's Jacob Hornberger, FFF.org. See y'all tomorrow.